I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Here we are, the 4th of July. Time to head out to the beach or take a longer, more thoughtful walk with the dog. Time to fire up the grill, hope that rain doesn't spoil the parade or the fireworks. And for those in the neighborhood, a walk along Boston's Freedom Trail.
My name is Jim McCuniff, and I'm in a uniform of the Continental Army, George Washington's Army. This is about 1779, and it is a musician's uniform, so it is backwards from what we think of the Continental soldiers to wear, usually in blue, right? Now, I'm in white with blue trim on my coat. I have a white powdered wig on with a black hat and white trousers and a red waistcoat or a vest. And the reason that the musicians, I'm a drummer, the reason they wore the backwards uniform was so that you could find him when you needed him. If you had all your soldiers that needed a signal to cease fire or to reform or something, you needed to find the drummer in a hurry. And if he was dressed differently than the soldiers, you could find him. So
it also might have meant that you didn't get shot first.
Exactly.
Right?
It was considered bad form to murder the musicians, right?
About 20 years after the Founding Fathers signed the Declaration of Independence, one of that document's greatest champions, the writer Thomas Paine, wrote a letter to George Washington. Paine was wondering what might become of these United States. 1,000 years hence, he wrote, perhaps in less, America may be what Europe is now. The innocence of her character that won the hearts of all nations in her favor may sound like a romance. The ruin of that liberty which thousands bled for or struggled to obtain may just furnish materials for a village tale or exhort a sigh from rustic sensibility. Connection listeners, that's where we want your thoughts today. How do we explain or define or live this freedom, this independence that we have? The liberty of that day is not in ruin, but neither is it in the same form as the Founding Fathers envisaged. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join the online conversation at www.theconnection.org. My guests today are Orlando Patterson, professor of sociology at Harvard University, and Jane Kamensky, associate professor of history at Brandeis University. And Jane, I will ask you to start us off. You study colonial times. What did independence mean in 1776, which is different from our understanding today?
Well, I'd say we need to think about three things to think about the meaning of independence as it's declared 225 years ago today. The first is its novelty. It's a concept that is strenuously arrived at even as the imperial crisis deepens. The colonists start with a conception of real authoritarianism and interdependence, of a conception of society that has a head above the king and limbs and feet that serve that head. And even as late as 1768, you hear architects of future American independence talking about their awe on seeing the King of England. So the idea of independence, as it's articulated in the Declaration, is something that is quite new in 1776.
Was it radical or scandalous?
It's strenuously arrived at. It's very difficult to get to. Even as the crisis between the colonies and Britain deepens, it's a word that that is sort of dare not speak its name till well into 1775, well into the Second Continental Congress. So its novelty, I think, is the first thing that we have to remember on the political landscape of the late 18th century. The second thing I think we need to recall, and is easier to recall if you read the document on the back page of your newspaper this morning, is its strenuousness. It's thickness. It's the duties that it calls forth, as well as the rights that it confers. It's a kind of independence that requires as much of people as it gives to them. It's a thickly thought concept. It's rigorous. And because it's rigorous in 18th century thinking, it's also narrow. It's also bounded. I think in 18th century thinking, it is not at first a contradiction that this language of independence and liberty and freedom arises in the land of slavery. But as Professor Patterson himself has argued, there's a nexus between being able to think about independence in the way that American elites do in a land of slavery, because the kind of independence they envision is itself bounded. It's bounded to the public sphere. The document you read in your newspaper this morning is about public life. It's about political life, not primarily about familial, not about families, not about individuals. It is at the same time that it's bounded to public and political life. It's bounded to the people who can express autonomy in public and political life. In 18th century thought, that means that you have to possess the property and wherewithal not to be influenced or swayed by the tyrannical forces that are always seeking to threaten independence.
Do you mean that it only then applied to the people who had the property?
Absolutely.
Or the wherewithal?
Yeah, so that property qualifications on voting are no contradiction with freedom in their mind, because you have to be able to own property in order to be able to exercise independence. Sex qualifications on voting are similar to property qualifications. You have to be able to have your own wherewithal in the world to be, in their phrase, a man of parts.
You referred to Orlando Patterson, my other guest in the studio, professor of sociology at Harvard. Orlando, this idea of independence, can we equate that with the idea of freedom, or are there big distinctions there?
It certainly was equated in the minds of the founding fathers. And it's important to understand that what happened in America then is was absolutely unique. It's been called the first new nation. Nothing like this had happened before. And not only in establishing from scratch, so to speak, a new nation, but also the way in which it was done, in a sort of revolutionary way. And it's hard in George Bush's America to think of America as a revolutionary nation, but that's what it was, and they celebrated it. Of course, very soon they began to have second thoughts about how revolutionary they wanted to be, but it's important to understand that in those first headed days, they did see this as radical, as new. Madison sort of was almost triumphalist, as were all the others, when he talked about in Europe, charters of liberty have been granted by power. Sort of America set the example to France, and France has followed it, of charters of power granted by liberty. And then, you know, sort of he pronounces a triumphal epoch of its history and the most consoling presage of the happiness of the world. I mean, this is the kind of language they're using. So they were aware of the fact that this is something new.
These words, though, the triumphantness, the glory, the
yes.
gloriousness of it, these are not words that are used today. These were people kind of like shuffle their feet and look a little sheepish when you introduce that kind of language into the notions of freedom and independence.
These were conservative men who got caught up by the times in a revolutionary act. And pretty soon they began to sort of say, my God, what's going on here? Suppose everybody really believes this, or words to that effect. And there's a real backtracking, so to speak, pretty soon. And, you know, as Jane pointed out, the idea that the mass of people, the unpropertied classes, well, of course, not to mention women and African Americans were excluded, that they would get this idea, which they did, by the way. I mean, everybody sort of felt, well, we're in this too. And that's when the leaders began to step back and said, wait a minute, is this revolution thing might be a little bit
out of hand?
Out of hand.
One of the things that happens is it's a language that escapes the boundaries that the people who originally state it place on it. So that if Jefferson and his co-authors in the enacting of the Declaration imagine this freedom as something that is revolutionary within bounded terms, by the 1780s, exactly as Orlando is saying, they're terrified that that the river has broken out of its banks. I mean, one of the first places you hear it is in Abigail Adams's famous letter to her husband John, where she jokes that in your new code of laws, I hope you will remember the ladies. And he quips back, saying, as to your proposed code of laws, I cannot but laugh, and talks about the tyranny of the petticoat. But in fact, what does happen is that the language of liberty is itself so powerful that it becomes a conduit for all kinds of discontent and all kinds of revolutionary feeling in other places in the society.
It's also that connection between property and liberty which ends up corrupting the original intention of the founding fathers. Not that some of their intention didn't deserve corrupting, but this notion that you had an obligation as a citizen within this virtuous state to participate, and then in the 1800s the state becomes a sort of almost an evil empire. Orlando?
Yeah, one of the most important developments or differences between the conception of liberty then and what was to emerge over the course of the 19th century, is that for the founding fathers, and especially for Jefferson, the state was not a bogeyman, and democracy, for those, of course, who were citizens and who had the right to vote, was something you actively participated in. Active citizenship and a good part of liberty then, in addition to being sort of not being dominated by others and being able to assert oneself in one society, is active citizenship, being engaged with the space, participating. But pretty soon, one of the important differences is that the state began to be seen as something, and democracy itself as something potentially dangerous. What if the mob, the masses, sort of took this literally and used the state to sort of to rob the rich, so to speak? But that tension between democracy, which persisted, of course. I mean, they couldn't get rid of it once that seed was sort of planted. I mean, in the Jacksonian era, there was a revival, and there have been sort of strong sort of populist tendencies. And but there's always this resistance. And we're going through a period now, in fact, of so-called small government, which is just another way of saying, in fact, the state is something potentially evil and should be avoided. And the problem with that is that that's antagonistic to the very meaning of democracy, which involves engagement with and participation in the state.
So when you are researching for the book on freedom and you're asking people what it means to them, what are they saying to you now?
Well, the most important finding I've had talking to ordinary Americans about what freedom means to them is a purely negative one. It's what they don't say.
Give me an example.
I asked them to free associate, to tell me what freedom means to them. And the one thing they didn't say was having a democracy, being able to vote. It's just really quite extraordinary. We interviewed 1,500 people in a national sample, and less than 1% mentioned anything to do with democracy when asked to talk freely about what freedom means to them, which is quite remarkable. And we've done that before and had the same response. This is very different, by the way, from Europe. When surveys are done in Europe, people routinely, a good proportion of people mention, well, you know, the fact that I have a democracy, I can vote, I can participate.
What are they talking about?
Americans have a very highly developed notion of liberty. They talk about, most important, being able to do what you want to do. It's a positive notion of liberty, being able to do...
In a sort of self-indulgent way, or in a nobody tells me what to do?
Actually, that's interesting. Most people are aware of the constraints that you do whatever you want to do to the degree that you do not interfere with others. But there is a substantial number of people whose position is, don't fence me, and I do any damn thing I want. And that's the most powerful expression. People have notions of rights and so on, but being able to do what you want to do when you want to do it is the prevailing American view of freedom.
Connection listeners, what is your view of freedom on this day in particular? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guests, Orlando Patterson, professor of sociology at Harvard University, and Jane Kamensky, the associate professor of history from Brandeis University. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. From Boston University, this is I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Here are a couple more voices from my wander along the Freedom Trail.
My name is LaVecchia.
My name is Paul DeBaney, and we're standing on Richmond Street.
You guys grew up on the Freedom Trail, or about as close to it as anybody could get, right? Do you forget about it? Does it slip out of your mind after a while?
I think it's like anything else. You're right there, and I don't. I think I've been in the Paul Revere house once by accident, and the Old North Church. I don't think I've been in there. Yeah, for a wedding, I've been in there.
But what about the word?
independence. Do you think about it?
No, I don't. It's a shame to say that because, again, you take it for granted. It's just independence. We've always had independence, and you don't know what transpired to gain that. You know, just again, like everything else, if you don't work for something, you don't appreciate it.
We're making the Independence Day connection. And connection listeners, when was the last time you declared independence? Was it in the voting booth or in your car? What's today's version of freedom or independence? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Now, Richard Ford, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the novel Independence Day, joins us on the line from Maine. Richard, the characters in your book spend a lot of time puzzling over independence while they're stuck in traffic or hanging out outside a phone booth. What does it say about the state of the republic?
Well, I think probably what that gentleman talking on the Freedom Trail just said, it's a thing, and this is the reason it turns up in a novel, any novel, that people take it for granted, and the novel then, mine, anybody else's that has to do with independence, tries to seize an occasion to bring that language into public discourse, into public parlance, because we do tend not to think about it. One of the reasons that I wrote a novel about independence is that I realized how much my understanding of it was constrained by conventional usage and non-usage. And when I found it circulating around in my notebook, what I wanted to do was put it in play again and put it in the mouths of characters, put it in the mouths of narrators.
Well, you mean the word, the word independence, the word freedom?
Well, the word, yeah, the word is the sort of the notated system for all of the notions and freedoms and pursuits of happiness that that underlie it.
You also choose a real estate agent as a person through which to help us experience that, and I'm wondering if there are connections there too. I mean, obviously, you did it on purpose.
Well, you do everything in novels on purpose. You hope by the time you're finished with it, actually, it makes me seem smarter than I actually ever was.
I'm always shooting for that too.
I just chose him as a real estate agent because I had Frank Bascom in another novel, and I was looking for something that he could do later in life that didn't require a lot of run-up. But I sort of fell into a piece of luck because being a real estate agent and being of a reflective mind, he was able to sort of conjecture about the spirit of the country. And since I set the novel on Independence Day, on the 4th of July, the spirit of the country was about independence for him. So much of buying houses and selling houses, and it has to do with people's expression of their independence, their sense of their well-being, their sense of how they exercise their freedom, their pursuit of happiness, all of those things.
I think your linking of freedom and buying, or independence and buying, is very much exactly where we are now. And there's an irony, a historical irony, if we start with a concept of independence that's strenuous but narrow, now we've got one that's sort of thin or flaccid but broad. So everybody feels they have it, but it consists of, as Orlando was saying early, the unit is the I, and it's the I can do whatever I want. And for do, you could often substitute buy. I can buy whatever I want.
Well, one of the ways in which Americans define independence, as you all have been saying, is through the access to freedom, which separates us from others, which is to say, I can do what I want, and I can do it when I want to do it, and I can pursue my happiness along without you treading on me or without my having to depend upon you. One of the things I wanted to try to find out was what lay beyond that decision and that choice and the expression of independence. In other words, what could you do once you had that freedom and were acting independently? And what I thought you could do most obviously, it has a lot to do with what Paine said, was that you could affiliate with others. Paine says that independence is the only bond that can keep us together, which I thought made the fodder for a good novel.
Richard, the the fate of the real estate metaphor is very interesting in the history of freedom. Originally, of course, I mean, we spoke of the land of the free and the home of the brave, but now, of course, it's the land of one's house and the desired home in the suburb, which is the embodiment of freedom. What originally was a metaphor has been reduced to the real, literal thing. But it's unfortunate that. And it ties up with what I was saying earlier, that there's a growing personalizing of freedom. It's been confined to the private sector. It's interactions between people and what you can get, rather than being tied to any broader organic body or entity.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I said we'd be getting some clever people together to talk about these notions of freedom and independence. Time to open up the telephone lines and let other people in on the conversation. From Coral Springs, Florida, Moen, is that how I pronounce your name?
Is right.
Yeah, you're part of the connection. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm not an American citizen. However, I'm in the process of getting my permanent residency. And I would like to start with one of the famous American immigrants' quotes. That is the novelist philosopher Ayn Rand. She said, when asked what it is to be an American, she said, I'm an American by choice and conviction. The thing what I would like to raise in this discussion is what is America doing about immigrants who come into this country? You know, many people are attracted by the economic security and the wealth, the big houses and the big cars. But there are many immigrants like me who really appreciate and cherish American values such as freedom, human rights, democracy. It's not really the wealth which matters for us most. It's the ability to think, the freedom to think, the freedom to hold ideas. So I would like to get some comments from your guests regarding these type of issues about new immigrants, and it's all sometimes it's even painfully slow taking the legal route.
No, I'm really glad you brought that to our attention. I find that it's often the immigrants who help us or remind us of the values that we take for granted. So, Moen, thanks for your call over to Orlando.
Absolutely right. In my survey, in fact, it turns out that the respondents who were most sort of who had the best grasp of what we think of as freedom, citizenship, participation, and so on, were immigrants. Partly because, of course, they could contrast their situation back home, which often is less than desirable, with what they had here. Therefore, they were not taking it for granted, as opposed to those who were born here. I should point out, of course, that one of the greatest of the founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton, was an immigrant.
Well, they were all immigrants.
A West Indian like myself.
They all came from somewhere else.
Well, I
their
guess
families all came from
yes, indeed.
Else.
Okay, yeah.
Sure. And I think from the early 19th century, there's a tradition of immigrants being some of the keenest observers and commentators, and sometimes participants in this political process. I mean, in many ways, it's de Tocqueville who gives us one of our most cogent definitions of what American independence means as a traveler who's looking in from the outside. So it would be wonderful if immigrants could reinvigorate that sense of sort of thoughtful, meaningful participation in our democracy today.
We tend to think of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence as being our founding fathers and our first patriots, but in fact, most of those people in the end of the 18th century thought of themselves as one brand or other of Englishmen, and in fact, several of the signers were in fact English, born in England, came to America later in their lives.
Indeed. I mean, they declare independence much more to recover what they thought they had as Englishmen than to strike out in some terrifying new direction, which is what, of course, they wind up doing.
That's the voice of Jane Kamensky. She's Associate Professor of History at Brandeis, Orlando Patterson, Professor of Sociology at Harvard. And before Jane, we were listening to Richard Ford. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Independence Day. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And John, you're part of The Connection. Go ahead.
Is that me?
Yes, it is.
Okay, hi. Freedom to me means one thing in a political context. It's the absence of physical coercion by the government. I mean, when you get right down to it, the government can only do two things. It can make you do something, or it can stop you from doing something.
Coercion to do what, John? Be more specific. Give me an example.
Well, a government, for instance, it only has, again, has one function. It has the monopoly, the legal monopoly on force. It can stop you from doing something, or it can make you do something. Pay your taxes. Don't park here. Stop making so much noise. Pay your bill. This you owe this guy. That's all it can really do, is arbitrate between individuals and make you do something or stop you from doing something. Now, it has the legal monopoly on force, and basically our government was conceived in such a way that individuals are protected by the government. Their rights are protected, and they're not coerced by the government. It was not conceived as a coercive agent, but a protective agent of your rights.
Are you saying that, that's better today than it was back then, John, or are you saying that we've lost the sense of what the Founding Fathers intended?
I think we haven't. I think it has been maintained, in fact, and I think it's the first nation that has been conceived along the rational lines that men should be free. They should be free from compulsion from the government. It was conceived along those lines, and pretty much it's been maintained that way.
John, I want to break in and ask a question. When you speak of the government, who's the government?
I mean, we are, of course, the government. I mean, all the people who are in this republic who elect officials to carry out the things we ask them to do are the government.
So I just wonder about how we got, as a historian, I wonder about how we got from a situation where people fought so hard to be part of that citizenship who elected the government, who, as you said, was the government, and now fewer than half of us vote for whatever conception we have of what government is or
and
does.
And we talk about the government as they rather
yes.
than us.
Well, I think we have a tendency to talk about that because I think people in a republic, when we have others who are elected rather than, I mean, I think people often think this is a democracy, and it's not. Because democratic processes are, you know, basically relegated to really low-level, government functions. That we have a constitutionally limited republic. That's how our government operates, and we tend to think of them as others because these elected officials oftentimes do not necessarily represent the interests of each and every one of us. And so, for those of us whom they don't represent the interests of, we tend to think of them as other.
John,
of course,
thanks.
It's part of the American sort of electoral gibberish, particularly from the point of view of the Republicans, to sort of make government seem other than ourselves, other than our gesture as citizens.
Exactly. This has been part of the problem, the demonization of government, the projection of government as the other, as something outside of ourselves, when in fact government, as conceived by the Founding Fathers and by all true Democrats, is part of us, is something we participate in. And but that's the tragedy.
Of course, we usually hear this from the Republicans, just as they're trying to get into the government as fast as they can.
Exactly.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We'll go back to the lines now. Dawn is calling from Lisbon, New York. Dawn, go ahead.
Hi, this is Donald Hasek from Lisbon, New York. And what I called about was when I heard you asking people to relate how well they have recently declared their independence. And just yesterday, on the 3rd of July, that our Green Party local and I declared some independence from the oppression of multinational, multi-billion dollar heavy industrial corporations.
But other than joining or saying your Green Party, what act did you take part in that declared this independence?
Well, the act was declaring my intentions of seeking the Green Party ballot line for governor in the New York State governor's race in 2002.
Well, I wish you would all declare your independence from Ralph Nader.
Well, that's interesting, because what we are seeing here is that in New York State, we're beginning to think very strongly about offering activist candidates, and we are very much into activism and seeking to have one thing, a platform that we will have in our campaign is to have an environmental bill of rights, you know, here in New York State, where every New York State resident has the right to a healthy environment, clean water, healthy food, healthy air to breathe, and we don't have that right now. We don't have the legal basis, any strong foundation for the rule of law and government to protect, as you know, what we heard from the previous caller, government acting to protect the citizens of the nation and the states.
Don, I want to interrupt you there and bring Jane Kaminsky in on this, because it's one of the things that's fascinated me about the way people participate with authorities in the last few years. You think of the young people who go to Seattle or go and make their protests and say, only by doing that do I feel like I'm participating. In a curious sort of way, Jane, they were doing what the Founding Fathers were doing.
I think with a twist, though. I mean, I'm always happy to see engaged participation of any sort among my students and the cohort of my students. On the other hand, it strikes me as somewhat ironic that the issues that have engaged them most are around consumerism and trade. Often, I think, not the kind of political declaration of independence that our caller is talking about with going through a party, but talking about, I declare my independence by saying I will buy green coffee instead of Starbucks coffee, that it's sort of hard to think ourselves off the grid, where the pursuit of happiness is the pursuit of wealth or the refusal of.
But we have to make our statement, don't we, Orlando, in places that we can actually control something by saying, you know, I'm going to buy this instead of this. It's not a big thing.
What about the voting booth as that place? I mean, you know, we have all these advertising campaigns. We vote with our dollars, you know, vote with your working assets credit card, vote with your gay pride credit card. Why not vote with your vote?
Exactly. So even these radicals are, in a sense, very similar to the conservative who simply say, let's leave the state alone. It's not us, it's them. But the problem is when you take that position, the them are simply sort of creating a world which may be very much opposed to your own interests, including your own freedom.
I think part of what's happened is, as we've talked increasingly in the post-World War II era, in a language of rights, and in a language of rights that has heroically enfranchised groups of Americans who were disenfranchised from the revolution on, Americans of color, women in the second wave of feminism, now the disabled, gay pride, the extension of rights to historically disfranchised groups. But that language of rights comes, I think, without the language of duty that accompanied it in the 18th
Exactly.
century.
Exactly.
Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, to join the Connection conversation about freedom and independence. The number is 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University.
My name is Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio, Independence Day Connection. My guests in studio, Orlando Patterson, professor of sociology at Harvard University, and Jane Kaminsky, associate professor of history at Brandeis University. And the question that we'd like to hear from you on is something about your notions of freedom or independence, how it's changed, what it means to you. Sebla is on the line. Hi, Sebla.
Hi, my name is Sebla. I'm Ethiopian American. Unlike most of the callers, I'm really enjoying being an American citizen, and especially as a woman, the freedom I've got in this country. But the situation with most immigrants in the United States, while we really certainly appreciate the freedom we're given, we're still torn apart because of our homeland. They don't have the freedom to choose their leaders, and situation back home, no education, running water, and all those sorts of things. We want this freedom that this country should expand to the other countries as well.
Why is it, Sebla, in your mind, that the American version of freedom and independence is a version that is so difficult to plant the seeds of in countries like Ethiopia, like all the countries? I know Orlando Patterson was saying in something that he wrote that America cherishes freedom more than any other country on earth. And why is it so hard to get the ideas, the principles out there?
It is difficult. This country is new, and your country doesn't stop in one place. You always work on it. You work on it, the amendment and all these things are going on. But in countries like ours, in the third world countries, we're just run by dictators. And right now, United States is in a position, being the only superpower, I would say under God, could really enforce that, not by force, through education. I'm a strong believer of education, through education. And the other thing is, like, as a woman, we have an organization which is located in Harvard Square, ADWAR, Ethiopian Women's Alliance. We're enjoying immensely the freedom we're given to have an organization run. So we would say that the United States is in a position to really help other countries because we're enjoying life here, but we're torn apart about what's going on, the starvation, lack of water, lack of education, lack of school.
Let's let Orlando in on this, Sebla.
You raise a very, very interesting and important point, freedom in the other parts of the world. Now, there's an organization known as Freedom House, which tracks the spread of freedom, and what has been happening is cause for celebration. Freedom has diffused all over the world, but there are still many countries which are still resistant. I think the important thing to understand is that there's nothing natural, necessarily, about freedom. It is, philosophers often assume that it is, that everybody necessarily wants freedom all over the world, but the historical evidence suggests that freedom does not come naturally, certainly not to those who are established leaders. It's something people have to struggle for. It's something people have to learn about. There's a culture of freedom. It's a set of values and ideals like a religion, which you have to understand. And the question then is, what do free countries, especially powerful ones like the United States, do? Do they try to encourage this growth? Yes, but how? I mean, you can't impose freedom. It's almost a contradiction to do that. Although it has been done, by the way. Freedom was imposed on Japan. It worked, but in most cases, it doesn't.
It's not a freedom of the individual, as Americans understand it, though. Jane, did you want to get in on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important also to consider the long legacy of the U.S. trying to impose U.S.-style freedom on much of the developing world. I mean, part of what Sebla describes, I think, is not only the legacy of internal strife in her own country, but the legacy of colonialism and Western imperialism.
Well, and the verb impose. Like, it's like something that you can't impose, right? There was that moment, that peculiar historical moment from 1773 to 1776 when they could do something that other people are not.
Yeah. Even worse, I mean, they weren't imposing freedom as they did in Japan, but in fact, encouraging the worst forms of authoritarian regimes, justified on the basis of very narrow conception of freedom, which simply means respecting property rights. And of course, during the Cold War, we had the horrors of the Southern Cone countries in South America, all the dictatorships which we supported, which is justified on this very narrow conception of freedom. Take the case of Chile. Imagine that. I mean, you know, with Pinochet's sort of tyranny, we still claim that we were in fact supporting him because he supported freedom. What did they mean by freedom? It simply meant respecting property rights. So we have to overcome a long tradition of really perverting our notions of freedom and suspicion in the world. But it can be done. And there are cases in more recent times where America has been prominent in promoting freedom, especially in South America, and hopefully we'll be able to do that in Africa.
Let's go overseas with a call right now. This is an American serviceman joining us on the line from Bosnia. I don't have your name, so tell me who you are and where you are.
Okay, I'm Sergeant First Class Christopher Larson. I'm with the Army in Tuzla, Bosnia.
And Chris, you've had a chance to hear a little bit of our conversation, I hope, about how this idea of freedom is seen overseas. Is it your experience that this is something people want to talk to you about while you're over there as a representative of the country?
Oh, absolutely. Everywhere we go, and in fact, you know, we are just the United States is one of 33 countries that have people in Bosnia right now. You know, people come up and see us, friendly on the streets. They, you know, we all wear American flags on our uniforms, so right away they know that we're Americans and we're there, and they're just very receptive to having us.
But are they asking you these sort of political questions? How do you get what you've got?
We haven't had any of that. actually, since I've been here. I've been here since mid-April for just about 3 months now. And so we don't get, you know, really any political questions. They're just glad to see Americans. You know, they don't look at the big picture, I guess you'd say, as far as political views over here, as far as American political views.
What does American mean to them besides that flag on your uniform?
I think America stands for freedom. I think it stands for independence. And I think they see that it means, you know, we as a people are able to do what we want, when we want to do it, without interference from higher up, I guess you could say, especially for the people that have been through this war that went on for the number of years back in the 90s, where they were run out of their houses, they were killed, they were, you know, given 3 minutes to get out or die.
Does it mean
that's all done now?
Does it mean democracy, being able to vote? Do you ever get any indication that this might be one of the things they like about America, or does that never come up?
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm.
It does that mean that, and they have had elections here on occasion. I think the last election they had was last year sometime. I believe it was just about a year ago, where they elected some new representatives to both groups that are governing the country right now.
Mm-hmm. Chris, thanks very much for joining the conversation. You enjoy your 4th of July in Tuzla, will you?
Thanks very much.
All right. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK to make the connection on this Independence Day. And we'll go to Kathy. Kathy's on the line. Hi.
Hi. Happy 4th of July.
And the same to you. What's on your mind today?
Well, I've been listening to these very interesting threads from your commentators, and I actually was wanting them to talk a little bit more about contemporary applications of the Declaration of Independence. I think that Professor Kamensky used the terms strenuous and narrow in terms of the original signer's intent of what independence would be. And in a very peculiar way, it seems to me that the person who most strenuously and narrowly has interpreted the Declaration of Independence in recent years, unfortunately, is Timothy McVeigh. So I was wondering if your commentators would be willing to evaluate his actions and statements vis-a-vis the Declaration of Independence and think a little bit about the difference of between freedom and independence.
Well, there's a rather extreme perspective on independence, but Jane, I'll ask you if you want to answer.
McVeigh, of course, and his... hi, Kathy.
Hi.
McVeigh and his... his cohort, not co-conspirators, I guess we're not allowed to say, interpret the Declaration less than they interpret the Constitution. And their construction of our fundamental rights, I think, is narrowed to point two of the 10-point Bill of Rights, the right to keep and bear arms, often against other provisions of the Constitution that talk more broadly about equality. I think it is fascinating that, as so many of us have interpreted our freedom as the freedom to be left alone or to be, as that last caller from Tuzla was saying, without interference, and have taken our freedom not to vote, that some of the people who still do take the founding ideology of the country most strenuously are people who would work, as McVeigh did in a spectacular way, to subvert many of its founding principles. And I think one of the threads that runs through this conversation is the danger of the more we conceive of the government as a group of them, the more it's left to those really eccentric and I think in many ways lone individuals who are still treating our ideology as something strenuous. And McVeigh is certainly the most obvious one of them.
Yeah, I should reinforce that Timothy McVeigh is an example of an extreme case of what happens when you insist on seeing the state as a demon and conceiving of freedom as freedom against the state, and to the point where you will kill over 100 people because they're associated with that state in your mind. It's an insane sort of position, but it's the logical outcome of viewing the state not as something which you become involved with, engage with, and by doing so, in fact, protect yourself from it, but also actively participate in it, as Jefferson recommended.
And Kathy, thanks very much for your call, because when Kathy name Timothy McVeigh, what popped into my head was a reference in one of your writings, Orlando, I'd seen, where you talk about the high rate of execution in the United States, the high rate of incarceration in the United States, as demonstrations that this type of freedom, this type of independence, may not be working as well as we like to think it is.
Exactly. It's quite extraordinary that this country, the land of the free, should incarcerate a greater proportion of its population than any other country in the world. I mean, why is that?
And you put those high rates up against our epically low rate of voter participation. So that, as one of the first callers said, not only are our elected representatives not in a direct democracy representing anybody, they're certainly not representing the, 52% of the people who didn't vote in the last election. I mean, I wonder what, if you could look at America in 1848, where the campaign for universal white male suffrage has virtually been won. So if you're a white man, you can vote. The campaign for woman suffrage is underway. The campaign for the liberation of slaves and the enfranchisement of African Americans is underway. So you have most of, and the campaign for Native American enfranchisement is underway. So most of the disfranchised constituencies of the United States are working for the vote. Participation in elections hovers around 80%. If you could tell those people that somewhere 150 years down the line, all their strenuous efforts would come from majorities of their population sitting home on election day, I wonder what they would say. It would be, I think, astonishing.
And I think of being in South Africa in 1994 when people lined up for miles because they were just so enchanted at the notion they'd have that opportunity to vote. Will they, too, in 225 years, take that for granted, or is that something peculiar here? Orlando, a quick last point to you because we have to go.
Well, I hope they do not. It depends on how the state behaves. I mean, people will vote when they have reasons for voting, when they're not demobilized, when the state is not seen as a bogeyman, when the state takes an active involvement with pursuing the good life. And of course, I mean, individuals then in the final analysis will be the one who sort of realize their own ends and destinies. But the idea of the state as a part of this process in which you're engaged is essential for any democracy.
I want to thank both of you for taking time out of your 4th of July to come in and share your thoughts with us. That's a very provoking conversation.
Thank you.
My guests, Harvard sociologist Orlando Patterson and Brandeis historian Jane Kamensky. Jane Kamensky is also co-editor of a web magazine called commonplace.org. There'll be a link to that on our website. Connection listeners, you can continue the independence conversation on our website at theconnection.org. And and thanks also to Richard Ford, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer of Independence Day, who took time out of his holiday to join us by phone from Maine. My name is Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR.